No. Dark chocolate hazelnut, no doubt.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's
the
amazing,
dark yeah. Dark chocolate hazelnut is the business. German brand, and yeah. A German sports brand, but it's definitely my favorite chocolate bar. Ritter, by the way, Ritter Sport, folks. Ritter Sports is the only chocolate bar you should be interested in. Chocolate Square, in fact. Adam Gordon eats the entire square once per day. That's no good. You've got to eat one of the little squares. That's how you do it.
So can I just quickly say something? You know how it's called Ritter Sport, and I don't think it's very sporty, really. And then you've got things like Ralph Lauren Polo Sport. Well, there was a lot of sport is attached to a lot of brands, and you know it kind of gets a certain type of person buying it. Well, yeah. When I was at university, my friend was going to set up a brand of cigarettes, and he was going to call it like Marlboro Sport, that type of thing, because he just thought there's definitely a gap in the market for this.
People that want to feel as if they're athletes, but in fact walk around, you know, no good. Anyway, welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. We are back with episode 67, folks. Delighted to be here, bringing it to you every Friday nonstop. It might be the 37th week of the year. I don't even know, but it should be because we haven't missed one yet, I think. So welcome everybody to the show. Very excited to speak with you today because we've got a special guest for us. He's actually a repeat guest, one of the few guests that we invite back because he was so good last time. It's Andy Foote, and he's going to be talking about LinkedIn updates. And today I'm thinking of bringing Andy back on a quarterly, actually, because LinkedIn changes so much. I think if we can get him to come in and say, look, last 3 months, this is what's happened. Would that be valuable? Comment below. Let me know if that's the case, because I think it would be. Anyway, quick sound check for everyone in case you can hear me, because I'm not sure you can. Crowdcast, if you're in Crowdcast, can you just say hello? Let me know you can hear me okay. LinkedIn Live, I believe we are broadcasting on LinkedIn Live. If you're there, can you just please say hello and say yes, Hung, I can hear you. Get on with it. And I should be on Facebook. God help me. Facebook Live, if you are there and you can hear me, please say hello. Okay, we're getting a few hellos there, which is good. Facebook's good, LinkedIn's good, even Periscope's good. We're all good. Anyway, quick word for our sponsors before we begin the show. Episode 67 is sponsored by our buddies at Indorse. Indorse are an amazing company coming out of Singapore. They provide lots of different services, actually, for companies hiring software engineers. So they provide online testing, which is super important these days. If you're hiring for people that are remote from your business, you need to test their technical capability. They do online hackathons. So if you're thinking about hiring people in bulk, technical people in bulk, they've got an online solution for that. And the latest thing, they've got a product called LinkedIn Metamorphose, I think. But it's there to help manage the sentiment of your remote developer team. So imagine if you had a team that was working in-house and you've had to send them, you know, in the COVID era, you had to disperse them back to home, but you need to monitor how they're feeling, how they're doing. They've got a product that sorts you out just for that. Free trials on all of those folks. So if you want to check any of those things out, go ahead and check out Indorse. I'm going to share the link in the Crowdcast chat stream. It's IND. O-R-S-E.io. Okay, on to the show, folks. Welcome to Adam Gordon again. Adam Gordon back on the hot seat. It's 2 weeks in a row for you, man. That's unusual, isn't it? Usually I upgrade you like every week, but I failed in 2 weeks' time. Two weeks in a row.
Well, I was thinking about that. 37 episodes so far this year. I wonder how many I've done. Probably 25. Somewhere between 25 and 30.
Vast majority. You're here unless you can't, or unless you're not interested in topic, or unless, you know, there's a better person, quite frankly.
I'm never not interested in the topic. It's always because there's a better person.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go to the brain food. Did you read it, man? Did you read it last week? And what was interesting?
Yeah, I did. So I am really, really fascinated by the concept of people selling referrals yes. into their organization. So yeah. I work for the company that everyone wants to work for. And if you also want to work there, then you can connect with me and I get money to refer you in for a job. Absolutely brilliant. I think that you liked my comparison with like Boba Fett would have joined this. Yeah, but bounty hunters, anything for money. You know, it's really unethical. I think there's so many problems with this, really big problems with it, but I'm not at all surprised that it exists. So fascinating.
Yeah, so for a bit of context for people who didn't read it, basically there's a second marketplace for referrals. You know, people pay referral bonuses for, you know, who do you know, help with work for us. Well, there's a website which actually allows you to post that opening, and then the person who is kind of volunteering themselves forward as the candidate will actually pay you to refer you that candidate into the thing. So if I wanted a job with Facebook, Adam worked for Facebook, I say, "Hey, Adam, here's 50 quid. Can you refer me?" You say, "All right, fine." In you go. So very easy to make some money out of it. It's obviously corrupt. But at the same time, it got me thinking, isn't the recommendation idea itself kind of corrupt? You know, the idea of recommending people, yes, we love it. Yes, it's a quick way to hire people we like. Yes, great for cultural fit, quote unquote. But at the same time, are we hiring the best people? Or are we kind of just, you know, taking what is low-hanging fruit and not asking too many questions where that fruit came from, you know?
There's been a long-held criticism of employee referral, which is that it's contrary to diversity, because if I'm going to refer my friends are probably white males in their 40s. So that's going to be a bit of a problem, perhaps. So, you know, if people are just paying me to make the referral, then that doesn't matter at all. So
yeah, it might help D&I. Would it though? I mean, it would, because the price is actually quite low. It's like $50. I mean, if it was a bigger number, I would have thought, yeah, maybe poorer people won't do it. But, you know, $50 is nothing for us, anybody living in San Francisco. Well, apart from, you know, people in work, I should rephrase. But if you're working, if you're going from one tech company to another tech company, $50 is throwaway cash. However, going back on your point that referrals can lead to poor diversity, you can also use it in a proactive way to tap into networks of underrepresented groups that can actually promote diversity at the higher level. So, for instance, I've seen one of the recommendations, if you wanted to, diversify your workforce, one of the things you can do is actually explicitly go to folks that are from underrepresented demographics and then go to them first with the referral scheme and say, "Hey, listen, we particularly want people that you know that could be suitable for this." So there's a yes or no answer to whether it kind of helps diversity or not, but it also helps depending on where you're looking for diversity. Are you looking at the level of the company, level of the department, level of the team, whatever? All of that's going to be different. That's another question for you. Which departments in company are the most diverse and which aren't? I bet you something, HR, not very diverse.
Florian's just made a point. Every Florian I've ever met, by the way, is really smart. This is another smart one. he's saying that like team sourcing sessions are great. You know, good, they're fun, good for devs to go crazy on LinkedIn. And I agree with that. A sourcing party, that's a good way of doing it. I wonder if you do a sourcing party, do the devs diversity, or whoever you're doing it with, do they do it for the pizza, or do they do it for cash money? I don't know.
Who knows? But it's worth doing. I mean, I totally get what you're saying as well, Florian, getting the developers involved in the sourcing, and actually they've got really good skills to help recruiters. You know, they could write the scripts that we're struggling to automate. They can literally do these things for you. So you can go ahead and do it. Okay. One more, Adam. In fact, no, two more. Let's keep going.
Yeah. Okay. LinkedIn's, on the subject of inclusion, I guess, rather than diversity, being able to pronounce somebody's name is something that's really important. Somebody did it to me yesterday. I got on a call with somebody. I said, "Hello, Hanali." And she said, "It's Hanali." And I said, "Ah, sorry. Okay, fine. Good." Right? Most people don't do it. They just let the other person continue saying their name wrong. So yeah. LinkedIn has created a feature which allows you to just click record, say in the name of your, say in how you, the pronunciation of your name, and then other people can see, how do I pronounce that name? Really smart thing to do. I tried to do it myself. I think it's probably quite easy to pronounce Adam Gordon, but I did try and do it myself. And unfortunately, for some reason, I think my Wi-Fi cut off halfway through it, and it didn't end up working. And then I couldn't find out to get back to it. So I only did it when it was referred. It was like right on my screen as a notification.
Why don't you follow my instructions? I mean, because I basically give you like an idiot-proof guide on how to do it.
Because I'd already seen it when I saw your instructions. I'd already been through that pitfall. But anyway, I will do.
I'll
go back and follow your instructions.
On this note, by the way, I think it's really useful tool, simply because there are people that obviously will mispronounce names. As a recruiter as well, when you're doing first contact, it can be really important to get someone's name right, because, you know, I'm sure the person who has Hanalei, for instance, having to explain every time, just gets slightly annoyed. And that can really kind of change the tenor of the conversation. If you're trying to open a sale, you're trying to kind of encourage this candidate to be interested in your job, and you've straight away annoyed that person, that can be really tough. So I've just shared the link in the stream there. Basically, this is actually a bit of Hung Lee content, would you believe? Hung Lee content goes into Brain Food. That never happens. But it was credit first to Rob McCargill. He's the guy that taught me how to do this. But there was nothing online. I couldn't find anything online on the how-to. So I just did a quick screenshot thing, put a Twitter thread together, follow that thread, and you can basically add a recording of your name or indeed anything else for 30 seconds against your name. A lot of marketing opportunities there, by the way, and then people can see and click on that sound sort of speaker icon when they hover over your LinkedIn profile, and then get to hear you say your own name. So hopefully that's going to help. Anyway, useful tool. Might talk about that with Andy actually when we get him on. But okay, one more thing, Adam.
Okay, one more thing. There's quite a few. We'll do one more, right? And then can I ask a quick question as well?
Of course.
Google removing personal characteristics for job ad targeting.
Yes.
Probably long overdue, I would think. So you used to be much, much more hyper-personalized about who you got your advert to. And they've removed certain personal characteristics, and that makes it it's not as good targeting necessarily for recruitment marketers, but really good for, again, another diversity subject.
I think I've got a big question mark against this, because on the same sort of next to that post is also how do you do diversity sourcing, there's an incongruous kind of situation here where it's okay to target people if you're actively sourcing, it seems. You know, but it's not okay to do that if you're advertising against them. And I'm thinking we're in a bit of a moral mess here, because what's the difference between me doing a Boolean search full of ladies' names, let's say, in order to get some female developers, let's say. I can do that. No one's going to question me on this. Everyone's going to say, go ahead, Hone, that's brilliant. And yet I can't create an advert which would simply target female names. I can't do that on Google or Facebook anymore. So I think we're heading towards a really weird place where one format is okay, the other isn't, but we're actually trying to do the same thing. It's a question mark.
Bit of a difference, I think, between giving you the tools and actually enabling the or providing the channel. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about it enough, but it's because it's a good point you're making here, but I think there is a slight difference between actually targeting adverts at individuals versus giving the ability to go and find. Because the thing is, if they're giving people the ability to go and find individuals, people could be using that for good as well as for not so good.
This is exactly what I'm saying. A lot of diversity sources and so forth have to actively target. In fact, we're recommended to do that. If you are looking to get more purple people, we talked about Jim Strachey last week, purple people into your business, you can't just go and advertise. You've got to literally look for them. And to do that, you'll have to put in these terms, which in an advert, which should be discriminatory. So yeah. we've got this weird sort of, the value system isn't aligned. It's definitely not coherent. And I'd be interested to know where we end up going with this. And like you say, I think the meaning on this, I think is the sentiment is always positive for Facebook and Google to try and stop, if you like, using personal data for targeted advertising. But you can imagine a lot of companies that are interested in D&I actually using that in order to get more diverse. And now they've lost the tool to do that. So, you know, it may not actually deliver the outcome that is part of the intent of this initiative. Anyway,
Okay, quick. Yeah, just a question. So I'm you know, every week, of course, I log on to the Hall of Fame to make sure that I haven't slipped down, because I know you're always complaining about my lack of interaction. And so I really want to understand, what is it that people can do to get ahead and come up that pyramid on the Hall of Fame? What is it that Kevin is doing to continue to remain number one?
Yeah, it's a controversy, isn't it? And by the way, folks, for people who don't know, Brain Food Hall of Fame is essentially a kind of a mashed up system that I put out there. Initially, as a thank you for people who've been promoting the recruiting Brain Food newsletter, I just wanted to say thank you permanently. Say, hey, put a Hall of Fame there. But then obviously COVID hit, and then I realized, you know what, I might repurpose this into something that might help people get jobs. You know, if you are available, there's a bandwidth slider when you log in, so you can say, hey, I got 10 hours this week, I got 40 hours this week, however much hours you've got, you can declare your availability, and then you can connect to other people in the hall that might also have opportunities or what have you. And a couple of people have actually got jobs through this, so I think definitely worthwhile. Now, there's a scoring system. How does the scoring system work? We'll publish that and we'll let you know. But essentially, it is about, are you submitting content that gets featured in the newsletter? Are you promoting the newsletter sort of publicly? Are you writing content or creating content that gets featured? Do you donate to the Brain Food Forest? All that kind of stuff. So as we keep going, we'll keep doing all of this. Anyway, check out the Brain Food Hall of Fame, by the way. Subscribe or sign into it if you're interested in diversifying your income. If you're looking for work, I totally recommend you go ahead and sign up for that. Okay, let's get on with it. We're waiting for Andy Foote. So let's bring Mr. Andy Foote on. By the way,
Andy's been networking like crazy on the side. I've never seen anybody warming up the audience quite as much as he has.
He's hustling, man. But I tell you, something special is happening here, because Andy is not only going to join us for a chat, he's actually designed a custom presentation he's going to give to the audience. So you and me, Adam, have got an easy job. We're going to sit back and just watch this. It's going to be fantastic. Andy Foote is one of the people who I think I'm always learning new things from Andy in terms of what is going on LinkedIn. He's also managing a group on LinkedIn, which basically gives him all of the inside knowledge as to what's going on. So we're all about to benefit from all of this. So let's welcome Andy on screen, and hopefully the tech's going to work, and we can see where we go. There he is.
Hello, hello.
Andy, how are you doing?
Good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hear you fine, mate.
Excellent.
Good to see you, sir.
And you, buddy. Love the way that you always big up me. Like no pressure whatsoever.
Hey, listen. Geez. No. Some of your blogs are actually the most well-read sort of articles ever on Brain Food. Like there's a massive demand for people just getting quality how-to insights on how to get better at the Big Blue. You know, this is the platform that we all are on. You can't avoid it if you're a recruiter. Arguably, if you're no good at LinkedIn, it actually damages your recruitment capability. If you're hiring for a recruiter, probably you should examine how fluent they are with LinkedIn, because it is the dominant app that we're using. Even though everyone says don't use LinkedIn, use scraping, use other tools. Yes. But it's still the thing you have to switch on after your inbox. So super important and great that you're here to share some knowledge with us, Andy.
It's always a pleasure. My only regret is that I did not get the dress code memo. Apparently it's white shirt. You didn't fucking tell me that. Thanks very much.
White shirt, gold shirt, mate. I mean, you got to bling it out as well, right? I mean,
and no questions at all from Adam. I don't want to hear from him whatsoever. His questions are always difficult, and I was surprised you allowed him to talk about the pronunciation feature. What else am I going to talk about now? I mean, thanks very much.
I just want to say one thing. Hung on the white shirt thing. Hung definitely follows the Barack Obama, Steve Jobs sort of process of wear exactly the same thing every day, so that you don't waste 2 seconds every morning actually working out what to wear. And I think that's a productivity mind hack.
It is a It is a productivity mind hack, and it's also a case where essentially, I mean, I've learned accessorizing is a thing, and I've also learned that I have no taste. So when you have those two things together, it's like terrible. If I was fashionable, I would totally wear different things. I'm not fashionable, so I wear a white shirt. Boom.
Did someone say taste? Taste? Ritter Sport. Well, it's obviously marketing. I mean, that's why, because once you eat it, you're sporty. You're not fat and lazy, and it's, you know, it's not bad for you. It's marketing. And it's actually Galaxy is number one, all right? Ritter Sport is number two.
I'm not sure I accept it. All right, we're going to have a vote on Ritter Sport at the end of the day. Oh, by the way, folks, if anybody's got any questions for Andy, please do ask them in the Ask a Question section at the bottom of your screen on Crowdcast. If you're on LinkedIn or you're on Facebook or you're on Periscope and you want to ask Andy a question, ask it in comments anyway. I'm going to try and get to it. We're going to try and monitor different channels this time. But if you're on Crowdcast, ask the question at the Ask a Question feature. Okay, Andy, we're going to go to you and you're going to share screen with us. Is that right?
I am, but Adam was raising his hand and I don't want to ignore him. Oh, now he's frozen.
I do want to ignore him. Let's just go to Europe. Andy, I'm going to focus the screen on you.
All right, here we go. So I am going to share my screen. Presentation that I was working on up until 10 minutes ago, just especially for you guys. You should be able to see it now.
Share screen. Oh, let me just focus it on the presentation. I think I can do that. There we go. I think that's right. Can everyone see Andy's presentation, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think I can. I just want to make sure the crowd can as well, just to make sure. Just comment on the chat stream, guys. Can you see Andy's presentation okay? No one's answering. I think it's just a lag. I can see it. Go ahead, Andy. I think we're ready to go.
Yeah, I'm getting the yeses now. Great. Awesome. I hope the font size is big enough. All right. So I've called it the LinkedIn Content Challenge because I want to focus on content this morning and, you know, content journey, whatever you want to call it. And so let me get stuck in. First of all, post quality. Let me just share this with you. So I put this infographic together a few weeks ago and shared it as a post. And what I was trying to demonstrate here was that, you know, the algorithm will actually decide the quality of your content, of your posts, of your articles, and it'll decide it before anyone sees it. Now, that's mind-blowing. How does it decide? On what basis does it decide? You know, we don't really know exactly how. We can take some guesses, and I'll delve into that some more. But that's, I think going to surprise a lot of people. It's like, wait a second. The algorithm is going to judge the quality of my content before it reaches anyone at all. All right, so think about that. And then, of course, LinkedIn is very mum about it. It's either low quality or good enough quality, I guess. They refer to low quality. And then what happens if it is low quality? I'm going to say it's crap in my language. If it decides it's crap, then it shows it to no people. Or it might show it to some people just to confirm its crapness. If it's not crap, if it's great, then it shows it. Definitely shows it to some people, and the people that it shows it to in that initial round of testing, if they engage by reacting or commenting or in fact even resharing, then the algorithm is kind of confirmed that, yeah, we were right. And so we'll continue to do that round of testing. So it keeps on doing the test, keeps on doing the test, and it tests and tests and tests until it peters out, until it's had its life. Now, are there some posts that get an awful lot of engagement fast? Yes. Do human editors come in at that stage? Yes, they do. But if you think about it, the algorithm is the only way, apart from subscription, right? We can talk about that. But the algorithm is the only way to act as the hopper for all of the content that's produced daily on the LinkedIn platform. So they need a funnel to figure out what to do with it, all of the content that we're producing. So that's essentially what that infographic was getting to. I want to move on to something that I spotted. I think it was, I don't think 1 year is, that was the time of this, the screenshot. This was back in 2018. There was a presentation by Bonnie Barilow, who's a data science manager. And the presentation was pretty good, but what was more interesting to me were some of the questions that she fielded towards the end of her presentation. It's on YouTube, and I can give you guys a link later. So one of the questions was, how do you use the quality of the post to optimize the feed? And her answer is, well, we don't have a lot of engagement data before a lot of people have seen a post. So in that sense, we don't have that objective measurement of how much people are going to like to see it, to like it if we see it. But what we do have is all the attributes of the post. So this is all about the post quality. So they're looking at the member who posted, its content, its text, any photos that are on it, the relationship between the poster and the potential viewer. So all of those things are what we use to decide the expected quality of the post. And someone pointed out, a friend of mine pointed out in comments to this post, she said, well, expected quality, surely she means expected popularity. And I think that's right, right? So it's the expected popularity, I think, is more accurate of the post as a signal of whether it's good rather than its inherent attributes. So that, I think, is very interesting that they're making this decision before anyone sees it, and they're trying to decide on the basis of their various data points of, you know, what makes a good, high, low quality post.
Andy, quick question. Yes. Somebody's asked in the questions, is the number of contacts or followers that a user has, does that bear any influence on this whatsoever or not?
Great. So that whoever asked that question is bang on, because that's something I'm going to come to, because that was actually one of the other questions that was asked from the audience after Bonnie's presentation. So let me get to size of network in a moment. But that's a great question, whoever asked it.
It was personal veritum, which is not a real name, so that's why I didn't say that.
Okay, so I zeroed in on whether or not historically you were able to build up any momentum, right? And I asked Bonnie this. I said, so really, you're only as good as your last post, then, is what you're saying. And she said that wasn't quite right. I think that I am right on this. I think that the way that it's set up currently is it's always looking for fresh content. The algorithm is always looking for fresh content. And guess what? If your last one or your last two posts stank, then I think that's something that the algorithm takes into account. So I think the more success you have on the batting rate, I think that factors in. I think you do build up some steam. All right, so yeah, so Bonnie says, hi, Andy, just wanted to shed some light on this. When I said historically the model was focusing more on the past engagement of a post as a signal of whether it's good, I meant the past engagement on that particular post, all the engagement it's already gotten before a particular viewer sees it. So that's quite confusing, but she is measuring engagement and I guess the buildup of engagement, but she's not talking about your batting record, your history of all your prior posts. In other words, historically, the feed couldn't do a very good job of predicting the quality of a particular post until the post had already gotten some engagement. Now, the feed is better able to start predicting the quality. I think she means the algorithm is better able to predict the quality of a piece of the content as soon as it's posted, before anyone ever sees it. And then it continually updates that prediction. So in other words, the testing that I was talking about. So, you know, the next paragraph is my comment in quotes. LinkedIn will rely less on prior engagement going forward. All the content you wrote before, yeah, that's in the rear mirror. She says that's not accurate. On the contrary, if you regularly post thoughtful content that sparks interesting conversations, the feed will learn strong affinities between you and the people you talk to. Now, those are two separate things. I'm talking about, is there some way of building up momentum? and she doesn't really address that. She's talking about affinities, and they're two very different things. All right, so I'm talking about, can I become known as a great author? Is LinkedIn going to reward me? Is going to give me further reach because of that? And she hasn't answered that. She's talking about affinities, and they're two separate things, and they're important, and I'll show you why in a short while. So, yeah, the question that was asked is this, basically the question from the audience. Not you know, English was not I think his first tongue. He says, is there any use of the percentage of people that are in your network compared to how many react to your content? So she says the feed has a sense of affinity between members. So if you and I are connected, but every time you see my post you never respond to my post, the feed will learn not to bother showing you my post anymore because it's not going to work. So in that sense, if someone is connecting to a bunch of random people, right, but never talking to them, it won't really get them anywhere because the feed will learn that these people are not actually interested in each other. And my bit at the bottom is confirmation that building a network on LinkedIn is all about connecting rather than collecting. If you have weak ties, your content will die on the vine. So I think that answers the question, right? I think we're all in aggressive network building mode, right? I think we all have a sense that having a larger network is going to be much more helpful to us, more beneficial to us than having, you know, only people you know in real life. I think most of us are beyond that. So we're building in the hope that, well, maybe this benefits me in some way. But I think it's clear from what Bonnie was saying, and I think we understand this, people who regularly post content, is that it's not about having thousands of people either in your follower bin or your connection bin, right? That doesn't matter. What matters are your fans, and it matters, it's two-way. So you, if you want to create more fandom, then you have to go out and you have to actually click on other people's content. You have to engage on it to strengthen those ties. If you want a particular person to become a fan, you must become a fan of theirs if you want to carry on, you know, building your fan base out. So that's, I think, an important distinction, because you can have thousands of people in your network, but the reality is the vast majority of them are going to be lurkers, right? The vast majority are never going to stick their head above the parapet, and they're never going to engage on your stuff. You're just collecting those folks. The fans, on the other hand, those are super important, because within the first hour of posting something, if you only get a handful of people who will respond either by reacting, by commenting, or by resharing, then you're probably not going to get much reach. However, if within the first hour you get over 30 reactions and over 20 comments, you're off to the races. And I can talk more about that. The other question that I thought was interesting after Bonnie's presentation in 2018 was the question of bait posts. So she called them like baity. The question was, wonder if you've seen behavior changing perverseness, and she was talking about rats in the actual presentation. It's fascinating, and how you specifically respond to these kinds of cases. So she says, so certainly any system can be gamed, and I think we're just trying to do a good job of making sure that we're not relying too much on any one signal. So for example, writing a very like baity post that's very easy to like might cause broad distribution, so we wouldn't want to, and she peters off, if all we optimize was for likes, for example, then like bait could take over the feed. But using a more diverse selection of signals helps make sure it's harder to gain. So they're obviously looking at all of the data points that they can get. And, you know, some of these data points will be negative, some will be positive. So the obvious positive ones are if someone follows you, if someone likes or reacts now, right, to your content, comments, and the reshares. Now, I have no idea if there's any weight or, you know, how much weight there is to any of those things. But to me, my sense, and I think a lot of people do this on a regular basis, will definitely say comments. Comments has to be one of the most important data points, right, in what the algorithm looks for. And I think it's not just the comments received. I think it's also the author's comments. I think it's your responsiveness. I think that's also factored in when deciding, you know, reach. Resharing is an odd one. we can talk about that, but resharing, it seems like it would, it ought to have a lot of weight, but it doesn't apparently have as much as you'd think. If people are willing to take the time to actually reshare your content, you'd think, wow, that's quite a strong signal, and it doesn't seem to be treated as strong or given the, you know, the weight according to the algorithm in terms of, you know, historically what we've seen in terms of stats. So that's like Basie, she used that example. And then the other thing I was going to say was, yeah, negative signals. So for example, if someone is blocking you, or if they're muting your content, if they're deleting your content, right, think of all of the actions that you can possibly take around content. Everything is taken into account. And of course, it's always changing, right? So this was 2018, this presentation by Bonnie. The most recent thing was dwell time. So I'll talk about that. So dwell time, in essence, is trying to build a better mousetrap, because what LinkedIn have realized is they absolutely need to get the home feed sorted. By sorted, I mean it's essential for them to make that a place that people will actually check. They need people there. Why? Well, because it's all about the money. Follow the money. They put sponsored content there. All right. So apart from needing members to be tuning in and to be constantly on the platform, constantly producing free content for them, they need them to be checking their home feed, or now, you know, as it's been renamed, their news feed. That's important. Words matter, not your home, but your news feed. They need it to feel newsy to you, something that you need to check on a regular, you know, basis. So they need it to work. And what's happened, my deduction is that it's too much. It's a big ask for users to actually train the home feed. I don't want to do it. I've got a ton of better things to do with my time. I'm sure you don't want to do it either. And it's just a chore, right? Who wants to go through all of the crap just to find the good stuff? Who wants to go through all of the noise just to find the signal? We don't do that. We don't want to do it. And so they came up with dwell time, which in essence is monitoring our behavior over the home feed. So what are we doing? What are we slowing down on? That's the first measurement. Oh, he slowed down. That's cool. Interesting. Noted. Oh, he clicked. He clicked. Well, that's another part of what we should be measuring, right? After the click, how long did he spend on that particular piece of content? Oh, let's measure that. And when did he bounce? Let's measure that. And how often is he doing it? What kind of content is he doing it on? Etc., etc. So that's dwell time, and it's pretty clever, and I like it, because anything that takes the work away from me to surface, to feed me more interesting stuff, then I quite like that machine learning approach, and that's what dwell time is. And I wrote a post about it here, and I just basically summarized what I wrote there. All right, the rebranding of the home feed to the news feed. And LinkedIn data scientists needing a better mousetrap. Because dwell time is always measurable, real valued measure of engagement, can be more reliable indicator of engagement, and no shortage of signals. No shit, right? Lots of signals there. All right, so any questions about that? Or we can do Q&A at the end. Happy to do either. Any questions?
Let's keep going. Okay. Any questions anybody has, please put them in ask a question section. I just want to emphasize that. Reason is because we can then collect them together and then answer them in order. And once we answer them in order, what I'm actually trying to do is also clip them so that we'll have things that we can send. Basically, here's a question, Andy answered it. Boom, you've got 10-second video on that. So ask questions where we need to be. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, so the next thing, I wanted to do a bit of a pivot to polls, and you'll see why. I think I like polls because it was a brand new feature, and I had to get early access to it. So of course I jumped straight in and I started producing all of these polls, and I was looking for, all right, what gets engagement, but I was also looking to understand how my network, my immediate network and their immediate network, how they think. And because that's the reach, right? It's still governed by the algorithm. So it's treated exactly like a post. But interestingly, polls, you never get any stats, which is really, really weird, right? LinkedIn made that decision not to give the poll author, any stats other than just the poll stats, you know, who voted and how. And that's, you know, that's about it. And then they'll give you a timestamp. So turning to polls, I'm using polls certainly for gathering intel, trying to understand my audience better, my tribe better. And I'm trying to be as creative as possible. And I'm poking and trying to understand, you know, what's going on with content too. And I'm also looking for engagement. They're definitely an engagement tool as well. And I'll show you how. But so an obvious one for me would be, do you know how the LinkedIn algo works? And, you know, this is exactly what I expected, right? The vast majority of the people in my immediate network and theirs, not really. Now, you know, let's leave sample size out of it, because I don't think any poll on LinkedIn are going to be terribly scientific or, you know, statistically accurate. And I think, you know, I'm not a statistician, but most people, I think people who are will tell you why, and that you really need, I think you need two things. You need to have a decent, and we could talk about, you know, what a decent sample size is, but you also need to have a properly constructed poll, you know, to get the best in terms of accuracy. So, yeah, how does the algo work? Well, people don't really know. Which is good for me, obviously, because I can try and tell them, and they can decide, well, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, if Andy's observed this, I've also observed this. So that seems to be true. And of course, it's changing all the time. So the other big question about the algorithm and the content journey or the content challenge is, does adding a URL in your post body harm reach? And there's still, you know, a lot of finger in the air stuff with the URL. Recently, you know, this was some time ago that I did this poll. But recently, a lot of the people who are studying this, observing content movement throughout LinkedIn, they're saying, actually, I'm finding that adding a URL in the post body actually does not harm reach. And I'm hearing that from a lot of people. And I think that's true. I think that's what I'm seeing too. So we may not have to do the gymnastics of putting a URL in the first comment and then going back and editing it in, which was, you know, the common method to try and psych the algorithm. So test that for yourself. But you can see from that poll some months ago that a lot of people really didn't know whether it did or did not. And, you know, only 69 votes. And here's what I'm asking about the quality part of it, right? The algo test content for quality. Should users be told what this means? Clearly, you know, a lot of people would say yes to that, right? Why would you say no? LinkedIn actually had
Was it LinkedIn people who said no?
I'm guessing yes. So hashtags, I wanted to ask about, that's the other thing that people talk about a lot is, so how important are hashtags in relation to content on LinkedIn? And from this, right, it's a badly constructed poll, right? I should have just gone for very important or not important. IDK, you know, that doesn't really tell you anything, does it? But however, you know, the deal with hashtags is that last year, Pete Davies, who incidentally recently left LinkedIn, he was a LinkedIn spokesperson responsible for product development and a few other things. He's recently left, and I'm trying to get him on my podcast. He says I can't talk about LinkedIn. But last year, he kind of became famous because he was the person that said, look, it's a maximum of 3 hashtags. And it's so unusual for LinkedIn to be so prescriptive when it comes to content and the algorithm. And so I took that as gospel, and I keep telling people it's 3, all right? It's 3, no more than 3. And then, you know, I've shared this before, but there's some other testers out there who found that if they analyze the URL of a post, they would see the first 3 hashtags in the actual URL, all right? So that's another, I think, clue that you know, there's something to that. However, you know, when all is said and done, you have something as recently as this from Jia Ding, who's the director, right, of data science at LinkedIn. Look how many hashtags she's using. She's using 6. So WTF, right? It's like, all right, well, Pete's told us this last year, and now Jia, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, right, 6. All right, so it's confusing. It's confusing as heck. So, yeah, I just throw that bomb out there. And then, you know, using polls and understanding polls better. Like I said, for engagement purposes, I love using polls. This one was one of my best in terms of, you know, how many votes I got, right? Almost 2,300. Awesome. But I'm not really that bothered about the votes. What I'm more interested in are the comments. 538 comments. Now, I don't have any views on this. Like I said, you don't get stats with polls for some weird reason. And this is, I think, it's close to the perfect poll, because what I'm doing here is I'm asking about something that everyone does. All right. So this is going to be universally of interest. Everyone has a sign off. Everyone does it differently. And that's why I started the poll, because I keep messing around with my sign off. I can't decide what to end with. Right. And I probably overanalyze and overthink it. And I keep switching. Well, some of the interesting comments that came out were that, you know, the U.S., anyone in the U.S. forces will sign respectfully. So that's kind of code. Even when they leave the service, it's like a code. It's a shout out. Hey, I served. And that's, you know, one of the takeaways that you get from all of the juicy comments. And of course, if you were thinking about repurposing content, then polls are perfect for this, because this you can spin out to articles, posts, whatever. So I love that, Paul. I wanted to share that with you in terms of, you know, getting engagement, thinking creatively about what you can do on LinkedIn. And then the other thing I wanted to end on was, you know, comments in and of themselves are very important, because what you're doing is you're elevating your brand, you're engaging with both fans and new potential fans. And if you nail the comment, if you add value, right, in the shortest possible space, if you're brief with your words, but they're, you know, they hit the target as far as the audience is concerned, then it really pays off. So Charlie Wyman had this poll, and she said, based on your own experience so far, what do you think is LinkedIn's biggest strength when it comes to business development? I think there's some more to that. And then her four were lead generation, follow-up, collab, direct sales, prospecting. Now, I don't know if she did this intentionally, but people will have other reasons for using LinkedIn or see other benefits, right? So I chose number five, and my number five vote was showing off. I think the LinkedIn platform is unmatched when it comes to raising your profile. Everyone here has an equal opportunity of being a standout when it comes to knowledge sharing. Not only does LinkedIn make it incredibly easy, they also give an expanding menu of ways to share know-how. Posts, articles, LinkedIn Live, native video, polls, stories, featured section, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I said, basically, it's the best way to sell yourself if you're selling, you know, what you know and what you do. LinkedIn provides the highest ROI. So I get 72 likes on that. And I'm getting some discussion around that, too. So, you know, this I think nailing the comment is important. It helps if you're adding value. The 72 likes, you know, that's from a combo of my fans and from people who say, oh, who's this Andy Foot fella? And then, you know, they might jump onto my profile and check me out and potentially become a client, right? The other one that I want to share is from Arena. Why do people share how to make a post go viral? If you want a post to go viral, you need to know what trigger sharing, etc. And I took a different tack. All right. What I did was I said, look, I'm not interested in viral posts. I'm interested in viral engagement. If you write or create something that busy people take their precious time to engage on and have conversations with others and comments about, you've achieved something fairly rare and special on this essential and wonderful platform. And I got 80 likes and 50 replies. So I am trying to win the comments, right? That's what I'm trying to do, because then I'm at the top, right, of the comment stream. And so yeah, everyone has that opportunity. So that's the presentation. I've covered, you know, a couple of different areas, and happy to answer any questions.
That was amazing, Andy. Thank you very much, man. You can stop sharing screen, by the way, Andy. So go ahead and do that. Wow, I learned a huge amount straight away. Last point, by the way, we'll get to the questions in a bit. So if you have any questions, having seen that, please ask a question at the bottom of the screen. If you're on LinkedIn, just ask them in the comments. Oh, I'm going to get to them. I am monitoring on my mobile phone, so we're going to get there as well. But the biggest takeaway for me, Andy, on this, was number one, you got to engage people. Otherwise, they'll end up drifting away on the affinity thing that they have. Yeah. Whereas Hungry is actually very bad at engaging people because I literally don't go to other people's posts. So I'm one of these probably people that LinkedIn don't like because I post my stuff and I hope people comment on my stuff and then that's great, but I don't comment on other people's stuff. LinkedIn, I believe, has penalized me for this. I think my account has definitely been, in tech, we'd call it tarpeded. So in other words, it's just slower to do everything. Right now, for instance, LinkedIn Live used to guarantee 4,000 or 5,000 views guaranteed, no problem, given the reach I had, whatever. We'd be lucky to reach a tenth of that right now. And I think that's because I'm tarpitted. I think my LinkedIn profile, because of my failure to continue to engage with my connections and people and try to engage with me, that has resulted in my profile kind of in between being banned and sandboxed. It's tarpitted. It just slowed down. So I'm going to start talking to people on LinkedIn. That's what I've learned. How about you, Adam? What's the one thing you learned from that share before we go into the questions?
Well, I mean, I learned an awful lot, and I've written down a whole load of notes, and I'm going to be copying that. But I do have a question, Andy, which is, I don't think you touched on video, unless I was answering something, somebody's questions or something at the time. What about video? Is that something that we should be doing or should not be doing? And if so, should we be linking to YouTube or should we be doing it on the app on your phone or what?
Yeah. So I personally stay away from answering any questions about video because I don't have enough of like history, a track record of understanding exactly what's happening. But there was a very interesting study by a Dutch LinkedIn trainer called Richard van der Blom last year, where he tasked his local university marketing department to analyze 3,000 posts, LinkedIn posts. And basically they came back with all of this juicy data. And one of the takeaways regarding LinkedIn video at that time, so last summer, was the gloss seems to be coming off, the shine seems to be coming off LinkedIn video. And they could show that in terms of, you know, the content that he gave them to analyze, that people just seem to be going, you know, from this interest level to this interest level. So it was definitely, you know, it was reducing back then. I personally think the problem with LinkedIn video is that people don't know what they're going to get until they actually click and start watching. And they need to be able to be in a position to give that time commitment. And you don't have that friction with, let's say, a text post, because you can quickly scan it. And it's, you know, it's much shorter in terms of attention span. So that's the first problem. I think the second problem is, you know, we're not professional. We ain't professional broadcasters. And I think people are still looking for that. Sure, we can talk about authenticity, but I think they do want it to be professional. They don't want to be distracted, and they want the nuggets. They want the value straight away. So if you're airy fairy and you believe, you know, oh, okay, I want to, you know, have this little chat before I get into and get stuck in. No, that's not true. And also, I've yet to see something which is on video which couldn't have done equally well via text, right? So what is the reason? Why are you doing this on video if it would work on text? And I still don't see that. So those are the main three factors. There are some people who are doing LinkedIn Live incredibly well. I'd give a shout out to Cher Jones. And of course, the reason she's doing it incredibly well is no accident. She has 20 years of broadcasting experience. That's why she's so effing good at it. And these people who think they can just do it overnight and get better at it, why are we going to tune in to watch while you get better at it? Right. So it's similar with my infographic, right? You can do crap content or you can do great content. That's your choice. But don't waste our time with the crap. We need to see the great, and it's very competitive out there. And you know, as to Hung's question about, you know, being sandboxed, some of this may be related to dwell time, right? So if you're not producing content which basically helps dwell time, so helps your dwell time, then you may be penalized in terms of reach. I've been doing dwell time unconsciously or subconsciously, I'd have to be asleep. I'd have to be dead. Subconsciously, right, by using the post plus the document. That's my favorite form of content delivery. And what that does is I basically call it it's an article wrapped up in a post, right? So the post plus the document means that you can have many pages on that document. But while you have the people there and they're flipping through, you know, one page after another, if that's 17 document pages long, I'm getting maximum dwell time, right? So, you know, that would be, go ahead.
From now on, I'm going to like send a message on a document with like massive font, you know, like a letter per page. Listen, everybody who's on LinkedIn now, dwell time. Give me more dwell time, folks. Stay on the page. Give me some interaction. I'm on the mobile phone here. I'm going to talk to you. Believe it or not, I'm actually going to talk to you.
There was a good post. I think yesterday where an author had just put a text plus a graphic, but the graphic was a Where's Waldo type. So there were a ton of, you know, people. I mean, there were hundreds of cartoon people on this one page, and he was basically saying, "Okay, where's Waldo?" But he called him Bruno, and so that was his attempt to try and test dwell time. And of course, he got massive reach. In comparison to what he was normally getting. So it seemed to test the thesis.
Right, I'm going to do new stuff this weekend. Adam, you're going to say something?
Yeah, and I've still got a couple of questions for Andy, if I can, but it's up to you. All right, so what about sharing posts? So somebody's shared a post. Somebody's posted something and you want to share it. Every time I click share, I get like 25 views. So that doesn't seem to work. Thoughts?
Yeah. So I think that's still the case, Adam. I think, you know, the best you can do with a reshare is to give it legs. So give it as much of an intro from you as possible. Richard van der Blom actually says, well, create your own post using that content would even better. So it becomes your post rather than a reshare, right? But the Midway House would be actually to preface it and to introduce it properly. So do that rather than just resharing it with like minimal one sentence, because you're not trying and your audience will see that you're not trying. But I think of reshares as a redheaded stepchild in terms of the content challenge. The reason why is that, well, you know, I'm resharing something from Adam Gordon. Adam Gordon doesn't know, I was going to say, my audience doesn't know Adam from Adam, right? Because they're used to seeing my stuff. Who's this Adam Gordon guy? Why is that of interest to me? So that might be a challenge. That might be one of the challenges. But you'd think, yes, it's counterproductive. It's counterintuitive, because if someone's going to do that, it's massive effort, right, to reshare. It takes time. It takes longer than, could take longer than a comment. And yet it's not rewarded. Somehow, you know, it's not recognized by the LinkedIn algorithm as a good, right? A LinkedIn good.
One more question, Adam. Question for you, Hung, actually. How do you feel about getting tagged in posts?
I've already ranted about that. I'm happy to be tagged if people want my help, or, you know, it's like, hey, Hung, check it out. I'm fine. If I'm in a list of 25 people, because they want me to just amplify something, then yeah, that's super annoying. I mean, LinkedIn knows that's annoying. That's why they actually had the remove mention feature built in, so that you can go in there and just remove the mention, which I'm afraid I automatically do, because some people end up sort of responding to this and all you get is just noise into your feed, which really just interrupts your experience. You don't want that. So I think basically it's a form of spamming. I wouldn't do it. I mean, it has to be personal. Like anything, the difference between spam and non-spam is it genuinely personal? And when you are part of a mass tagging wall, it's like, I get it. You want me to help you. But no, it's like, I can't. I'm not going to do it. Anyway, right. We're going to hit these questions, Guru. We're a bit out of time, and there's 8 questions, and I've asked people to ask them here. So we have to go through them. Andy, quick fire. This from Tony Pitchford, my old mate Tony Pitchford. I've known him since I was 5 years old. Tony, hope you're well, mate. Right. Will quality filters on LinkedIn gradually destroy the attempts by some users to turn it into Facebook? I don't even know what quality filters are. But what's your view on that question, Andy?
Yeah, I think Facebook content is here, and I think it's essentially representative of how people want to use the LinkedIn platform. And it's all about creativity at the end of the day. If you can create something that is valuable, interesting, educational, and it's done in a Facebook-y way, whatever that is, then all power to you. But quality, you know, one man's meat is another man's poison. It's all about how you view it. And there's such diversity on the platform now, which is it's a great thing. Thank you.
Yeah, perfect answer. And I totally agree. Let's forget the LinkedIn police. It's like it's there to use. The users will determine. If you don't like it, you can ignore it or you report it or whatever. Yeah. Can Andy send out his presentation? No, Meg, he can't. It seems Friday is the worst. Oh, here we go. Amy has said, it seems that Friday is the worst day to post and get engagement. Is that your experience or something that can be known as a fact? So we're talking about the timing of your posts.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter what my experience is. What matters is Meg's experience. If she thinks that's the case, then good. That's what she's observed and that's what she's experimented with. And that's fine. So timing of posts, when to do it, that's something that you pick up after a long, long while. And it's your own exploration and your discovery. Mine happens to be, you know, Monday mornings for my blog is Wednesday lunchtime. I know that for a fact because I've got the stats, but everyone is different depending on where they are and how they do it.
Yeah, and also different, I guess, through your natural reach as well, right? I mean, basically, it's about your audience being awake or interested at that time. And because we've all got different audiences, it will. Exactly. So there's not an objective answer is your answer. Brilliant. Okay, I'm going to rattle through these. We've answered the hashtag question, Varun. Okay, we're at Trisha here. How does this affect the job seeker and where they land in the results of a recruiter's search? So does actually a job seeker's LinkedIn activity, does that influence their page ranking in terms of them being searched as a candidate?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would, you know, I don't know enough about this to answer either way, but I would say forget about, you know, search rank. I would just say if you're going to do it, then look at everyone else who's putting content out there, figure out how they're doing it, look at the engagement levels they're getting, see how it replicate, how you can replicate, so reverse engineer for you, and do it anyway regardless of search and ranking, because that makes you a better candidate, because you know, if you know, the barrier is low and not very few people are doing it in your space and you do it exceptionally well, that's something else that they'll think, oh, Susie's doing the LinkedIn content game very well. I think we'll have a chat.
You know what? I just want to underline that. Trisha, I'm not sure if you're a job seeker or not, or whether you're asking on behalf of a friend, but I absolutely agree that if you are prominent on LinkedIn as a job seeker, that's just got to be a good thing. You don't have to appear on a search. You're appearing in the newsfeed. It's better than appearing on a search. So it makes sense, I think, for anybody who is currently interested in traffic or eyeballs just to be on there and be interested in producing and in contributing to the conversation. Okay, rattling through. Adam, hope you don't mind me just piling through these. We've got one from Matthias Simu. He said, any advice on posting PDF? I see some get better traction. Does that apply to your dwell time thing or not?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Matthias, that's what I was talking about when I talked about my article in a post wrapper. That's exactly what I do. So I do the post and then I attach a PDF. And then, you know, I think one of my longest has been 17 pages or so. So do that. It's obviously a dwell time gem.
Cool. I'm going to do that. Adam, I don't know about you, but that's totally something I'm going to experiment with next 100%. Week. Yeah. Okay. We've got, this is David Barlow from LinkedIn. So thank you, Joe. You're always a legend. Right. David's asking this on LinkedIn, actually, how to best slow down people when you see their posts? How do you get them to dwell? We've talked about the PDF. Is there another way to get them to slow down?
I would be less interested about getting them to slow down. I mean, I would be more interested in getting them to click. So it's the first line that I'd be more focused on, and then just delivering the goods. So make it baity. So if that first line is really, really good, and then, you know, there's no filling in the sandwich, right? The filling is bare. You've got to deliver the goods after the first line. So as long as you're delivering the goods, then the dwell time should come naturally. And that's why I like the poles as well, because if you have that other as a third or a fourth option, then you're going to get maximum dwell time because everyone has a opinion.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, quick one before we go to the last question. Who's the best first line writer on LinkedIn that you know? Adam Gordon.
Andy Foote.
Andy Foote. Andy Foote, who's the best first line writer on LinkedIn?
No. Who's the best? So there's a ton of people who write great content, and I'm fortunate to be connected with a lot of them. And I also interview them on my podcast, Footnotes. So, yeah, there's, I'm not going to mention one. You know, there's, who's the guy? Morgan Freeman, right, was asked some time ago, so who are the people that you loved working with? And Morgan said, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Because he knew, right, that if you mentioned two or three, then what about the other five, right, that he forgot to mention? He comes off looking, you know, clumsy, and it's just a no-no. So that's what you do. You take the Morgan Freeman approach. You never, ever. That's why I don't like those shout-outs, right, where the Friday shout-outs, because you're always going to miss someone, and they're going to feel aggrieved and hurt. Just don't do it.
You know what? I did once write a post like that. It was like, oh, here are 40 people I've learned something from this year. And the first line I wrote was, look, it's impossible to write this kind of post without upsetting someone. So please don't be upset. It's just came. But I am going to actually contravene Morgan Freeman. I'm going to say the best first line writer that I know on LinkedIn, Mitch Sullivan.
Mitch is very good.
He writes brilliant first line, gets me every time. I want more. I check it out. Yeah. And he kind of delivers as well on it. So he's a brilliant LinkedIn writer. Go and follow Mitch Sullivan on this. Okay, final question. This is from Sharam. Sharam's asking, thoughts on emojis in posts? Good, bad, ugly? Do emojis help or not?
So I personally, as a writer, I just like the text, all right? I don't like any embellishing. Or anything that's trying to be an attention grabber just for the sake of being an attention grabber. I'm a purist. I want the text. If the text is strong enough, then that, you know, that will get the audience. I don't like the bit emojis. I don't like when people will put in GIFs or anything that takes up a heck of a lot of space in comments. I freaking hate that because it's annoying and it's, you know, it's like, I want comments. Why am I seeing this image, this cartoon image? So, yeah,
That's personal opinion, though, Andy. I know somebody who said to me about 4 years ago, they were absolutely adamant that within 20 years, we're just going to be writing to each other in emojis. It's going to be a return to hieroglyphics.
Yeah.
And we're getting there.
Yeah. So as I said, it's subjective. I personally can't stand them. But my point about, you know, in the comments is that it takes up too much space, right? It's kind of selfish that you're taking up like quadruple amount of space just for your cartoon. I want to read the next comment. So that's the main point. But yeah, it's, you know, personalization and, you know, your personality, sure. And I sign off with a smiley, right? I don't do the emoji. I do a text smiley. So.
You know, one thing on this, guys, and just to Sharam as well, one thing I've tried to do, which I think works, I'm not sure, but I kind of use emoji numbers to do bullet lists. I think it just stands out a little bit better. I'm not sure it has any kind of algorithmic impact, but visually, I think it's not trying to trick the user, but it gives people a bit of a look to say, oh, there's a numbered list here. And everyone likes lists. Anyway, listen, we've done answering that question. I think we've answered them all. Andy, we're bleeding into your rest of your day. So thank you so much for everything you've done. Can you quickly, before I let you go, pick out your podcast and stick it into the chat stream? Because I'd love for people to actually log into that. I assume you're going to be talking a lot on LinkedIn. So presumably people who are enjoying this post and want to learn more, they want to go on to Footnote and check that out. I'll obviously email everyone who has registered to this webinar to the effect of, hey, everyone follow Andy, because it is very important if you care about this type of stuff. It is fascinating. And it's a changing beast, isn't it, Andy? So I don't know how often LinkedIn ship, but it's like every day they push something and things change. So we've got to keep a constant monitoring of it. best practice yesterday might be the worst mistake today. So we have to keep looking at it. Andy, at the start of the show, I did say to Adam, it might be an idea for me to bring you back onto Brain Food, do a quarterly, let every 3 months we get you back to one of these. What are your thoughts on that? Would you be up for it?
I'm going to order my white shirt now.
White shirt, that's it. Bling it out as well, man. All right, listen, that's it, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. If you enjoyed the show, by the way, just say vote on something. I think there's a way you can do it. No, there isn't. You can just comment. That's totally fine. We'll be back next week, by the way, to talk about how to ask a great interview question. If you're a recruiter or a hiring manager and you're wondering why some people have really good, in-depth get to know you, really kind of deep connections with people, we're going to try and get to the bottom of what that is all about. No more tell me about yourself type of questions. It's going to be a fascinating one. Charlotte Mustertz, I've screwed her name up. I think she's watching this right now, Charlotte. I apologize. She's going to join us for that. It's going to be a fantastic show. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Thank you again to our sponsors, Indoors. Check them out if you're hiring for tech talent. Thank you, Andy Foote. Thank you, Adam Gordon. And thank you, everyone, for watching. We will see you next week.
Thanks, guys.